Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with the journalist Aaron Geiger-Smith, whose book Thank You for Voting, The Maddening, Enlightening, Inspiring Truth About Voting in America was just published.
Aaron has written for publications including The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, and has worked at Reuters covering legal news.
She has a shrewd perspective on the voting process and electoral systems in general that run our country, and she's doing some extraordinary work in helping us understand this issue and how best to mobilize in the run-up to November. Very excited to have her on today. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for asking me to do it.
So your book, Thank You for Voting, just came out. What's on the top of your mind right now in terms of this year's election?
Oh, I mean, it's hard to even rank. Top of my mind feels like it's extremely wide, but I will say, you know, I'm concerned about the mechanics of vote by mail working. And I think it depends so much on educating the voter. And so I think that's the top of my mind right now, is making sure that voters know what they can do to make sure their vote counts. I really try to focus, both in the book and just in general as I'm talking about it, on the parts that the voters can control. Because obviously, you can ask your senators to give more money to the Postal Service and to support local elections boards. But after that, there's only so much the voter can do other than prepare themselves. And I feel like the more prepared we all feel, the less anxious we'll be. But it, I mean, that's such a downer to start on, but it is, it's such a unique election. And you know, when you write a book, the world can change, but I didn't anticipate that the simple act of voting would be such a thing people would have to put so much extra thought into this year. Even the most educated voters have to be on their game this year, especially if they choose to vote by mail.
Well, it's just such an explicitly fraught moment, you know, especially recently, the last few weeks. But I do want to widen out a little bit. You know, we are in this, continuing in this global pandemic of COVID-19. Widen out a little bit, not too much. But
right.
and aside from sort of the obvious, how do you think COVID-19 is going to impact voting in this election, and how is it affecting the lead up, the voter registration, the mail-in ballots? So can you maybe lay out for us what's going on in this moment?
Sure. I think that the biggest way it's impacted voting specifically is that vote by mail has expanded so much in what states are trying to do in expecting so many more people to vote by mail. And at the same time, there's so many lawsuits going on trying to make vote by mail as convenient as possible for the voter. Mm-hmm. And so it's this constant push and pull between expansion of the vote by mail rights that already existed and other people trying to limit the number of people who do it by kind of making it more difficult. You know, most states, anyone historically could vote by mail if they wanted to via absentee ballot. And there weren't that many states left that required an excuse. Big states do, though. New York did, Texas does. But it just, most people had still chosen in the past to vote in person. So even states that allow it, some require a witness requirement. So there's lawsuits to take away that witness requirement during COVID. Some states it's a witness requirement or a notary. Tracking down a notary is a hassle anyway, and in a pandemic, it's even more of a hassle. So it's just this figuring out the basics of how vote by mail is going to work, and then making sure that the in-person component stays available. Mm. One thing that got confused in the early days of the pandemic, when there was a big push for vote by mail and trying to have all states get ready and allow it, it sort of became this conversation that people were pushing for universal vote by mail and we all vote by mail and that's the way it's going to be. But that was never really true. There always needed to be an in-person component. Some people don't have reliable mail service. Some people just don't trust it. We didn't quite anticipate the trust issue becoming so huge, but having enough poll workers is also a hugely important issue. So it's just all of these things that trying to make vote by mail convenient. And like all of our voting laws, it's so different state to state. So it's so hard to give any advice because all advice has to start with see what's happening in your state. You know, if you live in Colorado or Utah, all of this vote by mail talk sounds insane because you're already doing it and it works. And, you know, people who live in those states can't quite grasp why everyone's freaking out because they've done it and it works. A huge complication with American voting law in general is every single conversation starts with, hey, get registered to vote. But to do it, make sure you see how you can do it in your state. It was something that I found so interesting writing the book because I, you know, I was a legal reporter before and I went to law school. So I knew, I thought I really understood the complexities. But when you break down and look at state to state differences and, you know, how that impacts turnout, it's really fascinating.
You just mentioned your law background, and I was curious, you know, you've reported on such a wide variety of subjects over the years.
That's true. Kind of mix it up.
Yeah. Many of them not politically focused. So I'm wondering, how did you come to this idea for your book?
Sure. You know, covering legal news involves politics in a way, but I had previously always really stuck to the legal side of things. But after the 2016 election, it just felt like there was only one story. And, you know, when you're a reporter, you want to be involved in that story somehow. But I've never been interested in like covering the day-to-day infighting of Congress. I respect so much people who are able to do that, but I think it would drive me nuts. And I'm just always more curious of what everyday people want to do and are into. So that was kind of the start of it. And then there were just so many basic questions of what went wrong with polling, what role did the media play? And so as I was thinking of how to kind of work my way into that, I was scrolling Instagram one day, as we're all, or at least I am too guilty of doing, and Reese Witherspoon, the actress, was interviewing Ann Patchett, the author of Bel Canto and other amazing works. And Ann said that she was working on a book on women and voting. And for whatever reason, I was like, that's a project I would like to be a part of. And I'd written a ton of book stories for the Wall Street Journal. So emailing an author's publicist wasn't a crazy thing for me to do. And so I told Anne's publicist that if Anne needed any help researching for the book or doing background interviews, I'd love to help her out. So it started as a side project. Anne was like, great, what can you do? And she was working on a novel. And so I just chose a topic a month, African Americans in voting or the youth vote or gerrymandering, and was doing research for her as she wrote a novel. But instead of it being the small side project it was supposed to be, I just became obsessed. I mean, I spent all of my time. I essentially stopped pitching other stories. I mean, it was a terrible financial move, but I just couldn't stop. And then after I'd been researching for about 8 months, and the idea had been for me to turn over the research and help Anne on her way, but Anne needed more time with the novel she was writing. And kindly, she was like, Erin, you are doing all of the work. You're clearly obsessed. Like, this is your book. Go pitch it and make it happen. And so that's sort of the crazy story of how the book came to be. But it was just born sort of some big questions I had that led me to research, that led me to just become obsessed with the topic, especially with how low voter turnout is. I mean, it's just one of those things that you sort of know everyone doesn't vote and you can even know the numbers a little bit. But when I really sat down and looked at how low voter turnout was, how hard historically we made it for people to vote, just in our entire history, our voting history is so often one step forward, two steps back. And I, you know, again, that was something I was certainly aware of. But when you sit down and look at the timeline, I found it shocking and it sort of took me aback, which is why I wanted to start the book with the history to sort of drive home that those things that we think we know, but don't really spend a lot of time with. And so that's kind of how it came to be. General questions into obsession into all of a sudden I'm writing a book.
And you're from Liberty, Texas originally. Could you talk about the voting divide between Liberty and where you live now, New York City?
Sure. So Liberty is a very small town about an hour northeast of Houston, but it's not a suburb. It's a small town. And when I was growing up, it was 7,601 people. Now it's just a little under 10,000. But it's, you know, as one expects from a small Texas town, it's just a very red area that certainly votes very consistently Republican. And now I live in Manhattan on the Upper East Side, and it votes very, very consistently blue. But as different as one obviously might expect Liberty and New York City to be, I had always felt and do feel very much of both worlds. So how stark the feelings were after 2016 mm-hmm. really took me aback. And that may sound naive, but if you know hundreds of people literally in both places, and they don't have that different of values or what they want for their family, and it felt very different than it had in any other elections. Mm. And so I just wanted to, you know, learn more about that too, figure out what gets people into the voting booth. And then that sort of just segued into the mechanics of it and how low our youth turnout is, and that we just don't do a good enough job teaching young people to vote and all of those things. But mm-hmm. it surprised me after 2016. And then also in my early research on the book, there was a 538 analysis of how voter differences, a shift in Obama voters who became Trump voters, and they had broken it down by education. And Liberty County, my home county, was the least educated county in the nation, which also just really shocked me. Kind of the struggles that towns have, but learning you're from the least educated county in the entire country.
Still managed to produce you though.
Well, produce me, but many, many other people. But I had spent time in college really thinking about that, the divide, and Liberty is very racially diverse and those struggles, but it really surprised me, and it made me want to even more make sure that young people from all parts of the country are learning how to vote.
Well, as you say, I mean, it's amazing how few young adults actually vote.
Yeah.
And it also seems to be inconsistent. The numbers kind of wax and wane. So first part of my question is, why is that? Why does it go up and down, if you know?
You know, I think no one knows for sure, because young people aren't apathetic. It's not that they don't care about the issues. When presented with what do you care about, you know, people care about their education and they care about their healthcare. And certainly young people care about gun violence and they care about climate change. You know, for a presidential turnout, obviously enthusiasm about the candidate really matters. I mean, turnout went up for Obama for young people, just as it did for others. You know, he, especially in the first election, really got people excited. But even though it waxes and wanes for young people, presidential year turnout is still almost always below 50%. So it's never good.
But what's different this time? You know, 4 years for kids is a generation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's happened in the last 4 years is, A, Brett Kavanaugh, we saw things change after that. Mm-hmm. Things are occurring that are causing the youth to galvanize.
Absolutely.
And thanks to Nixon, you know, 18-year-olds can vote. So, mm-hmm. ironically, do you think Zoomers might have different voting behaviors than millennials?
I certainly hope so. And I think that there is really great reason to hope. You know, the best example that we have is looking at the jump from 2014 to 2018, because you have to compare midterm to midterm. Youth voter is defined by 18 to 29. 2014, it was about 20%. I mean, just terrible. Mm. By 2018, it had jumped, some say 31%, some say 36%, but the census numbers have 36%. So either way, that's a giant leap. I mean, more than a 10 percentage point jump. Mm. And that came from, you know, March for Our Lives was a huge impact on 2018 turnout. I mean, the shooting in Parkland happened in February. And to think of what those kids built between February and Election Day in November, that's a huge issue. Climate change is a huge issue for young people. And all of the march and protest all involved voter registration too. So add that to the huge youth participation in the protests that we're seeing now for Black Lives Matter. And there's really a lot of reason to hope that it'll be a big difference. Right before the 2018 midterms, I went to this event that was called Party at the Polls, and it was hosted by WME, the mm-hmm. media talent agency conglomeration. And so they had musicians who were putting on a 10 a.m. concert and then marched to early vote. It was a really great event. And one of the people there was Sheryl Crow, And she has participated in Rock the Vote for, I mean, nearly two decades. She has been such a staunch supporter of the vote. But one of my questions was, you know, you've kind of been pushing the youth vote for a long time, and there's always hope, and sometimes it doesn't turn out. And she said that she felt like there was truly a difference this time, like as someone who'd been doing it for a long time, that the issues just seemed so much more present for young people. And, you know, that turned out to be true in 2018. So I think there's a lot of hope that we'll see a big difference in 2020. And if you start voting young, you keep voting. So it's about building the habit. And I think what's also really amazing about this movement is there's such a focus on that making voting a habit rather than just vote. It's this idea of being a voter, that a voter is part of your identity. And that's a big shift too.
What did we learn in the primaries, you know, which are kind of like a test run? Were there kinks that were revealed that concerned you most? You know, what did you walk away with?
I walked away being super thankful that we had them because there were a lot of kinks that both the voter and the local boards running the election boards really had to figure out. I mean, preparing for just a massive influx of ballots is very important. Letting voters know that maybe sometimes voting by mail wasn't the best choice for them, or that you really need to get your ballot early. I didn't. So I vote in New York and New York City, obviously, and I didn't get my ballot. So I didn't get to early vote, even though I had requested it in plenty of time. I had to go in person. I mean, helping voters know that they need a plan and a backup plan. In my district in New York, it's been the one that has been held up nationally as being a giant mess. June 23rd was our primary. And I am pretty sure that as of today, which, you know, we're a little bit into August, they have not actually named the winner of my congressional race.
Wow.
There were lawsuits over too many ballots being thrown out. That lawsuit involved the post office was supposed to postmark all the ballots, but they didn't. And so through no fault of voters, their ballot may have been thrown out just because the post office didn't postmark it. So those things are big red flags that everyone has to figure out how to deal with. And I think also what we saw in Wisconsin and what we saw in Georgia with really long lines has led to this huge call for more poll workers and for younger poll workers. And that's also, that's an issue that's true in every single election, but this time there's just such a focus on it.
And we have all these arenas now that might get used, you know, for social distancing.
And getting, you know, companies and corporations involved in knowing what they can do is a big improvement. But yeah, being able to vote at the Atlanta Hawks arena and able to have that space where people can socially distance, but still have, you know, a ton of voting machines is really important. So yeah, there were a lot of lessons learned. Did they learn them all? Let's hope so and be prepared in case they didn't.
When it comes to voter suppression, what do you think are the most pressing issues right now and in the upcoming election?
I think voter roll purges are a big issue. And, you know, that's just not for me thinking it, but from what people like the Legal Women Voters say is their primary concern because of a Supreme Court decision. A few years ago, states can purge you from your voter roll if you haven't voted in two federal elections and you don't respond to a postcard. You know, that's a big issue. And it's why, you know, you need to check your registration early and often before elections. Not all states are that aggressive about it. So states are, of course, supposed to keep clean voter rolls. And, you know, if someone dies or you move, you're not supposed to be on the voter roll anymore. And that's important that states have good ways to do that upkeep. But what studies by the Brennan Center at NYU and others found was that states that had histories of voter discrimination were much more likely to purge their voter rolls much more extensively. So that's a huge issue. And it's something that organizations try to keep an eye out for and notify people if they may have been purged. But it's important to check your registration. So, you know, that's always a big deal. The long lines, which come from activities both nefarious and not, are, I think, a huge concern. You know, it's just very difficult for someone to wait in a 8-hour line. And that comes from disorganization at boards of elections or systems malfunctioning. So there can be many reasons, but also just the closing of polling places is a huge tool of voter suppression. And it's something that people just have to really keep an eye out for to check mm-hmm. whether your polling location has changed. But it's things like that, like that aren't so in your face. And, you know, one of the things that really stuck with me also from the head of litigation at the League of Women Voters was she's like, the tools of voter suppression happen months before when people aren't looking. And then you show up and you're at the wrong polling place. You know, you wait 2 hours to find out you're at the wrong polling place and you go to another one and you're supposed to wait 2 hours. I mean, it's just all of these issues, which is why right. the ACLU and others spend their full working lives trying to figure this out.
I mean, connected to this, voter fraud, as you note in your book, is actually not that prevalent. It's quite rare. It's incredibly rare.
Right.
Why do you think President Trump and the Republicans are so stuck on it? Or certain Republicans, I should say.
I think because it's just a really great scare tactic. Mm-hmm. And it also starts as an idea that any thinking person and believer in democracy is against. Of mm-hmm. course, we don't want there to be voter fraud. You know, so I think it's able to get in because when you hear about voter fraud, well, you think, okay, well, what's happening? Because we don't want some random person who's not on the voter roll showing up to vote. But it is just so rare. It's difficult to pull off. If someone does pull it off, the penalties are extensive, especially for non-citizens voting. I mean, you're likely to get deported. These mm-hmm. are not things that people take lightly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any history? Is there any kind of known story?
Well, you know, there's a woman in Texas who, I believe she was a convicted felon who believed that she could vote and she couldn't and did cast a ballot, but she got 5 years in prison. So it's examples like that that are really small. Or in 2018, there was, this isn't voter fraud, it was ballot harvesting by a North Carolina Republican, and they got caught. So that's the other thing, is if you try to do this sort of organized, larger, bad voter fraud experiment, you're probably going to get caught. It's just not prevalent enough to be of concern. And it's kind of an interesting thing about voter ID. So many states enact voter ID laws to fight voter fraud, but you're fighting something that doesn't exist.
Mm, right.
So like voter IDs don't keep that many people from voting, but we don't want anyone who should be able to vote to not be able to vote. And they cause that problem way more than they prevent any fraud because there's just so little fraud to exist.
I wanted to bring up the political conventions, which are kind of the next beat in this telenovela.
Right.
First of all, do we need them? And second of all, is this tradition the best use of our time and money for either party?
I think no. What we do need them for is we want, you know, all the television and cable news channels to take seriously that one big speech, because people really do watch it. I mean, many, many, many millions tune in to hear the candidates sort of give their best shot. And I do think that's really important. So, you know, that part should be kept, but it's just such a missed opportunity to have all of those eyeballs and use them for unfact-checked, total partisan speeches that aren't really helpful to anyone. I think that if they are going to exist, then it needs to be used to educate people on who's on their actual ballot. The problem with political conventions, to my mind, is they do so much to reinforce the idea that the presidential election is the biggest and most important and sometimes even the only thing, when really people need to know about everyone on their ballot. Mm-hmm. Because I think coronavirus has taught us many lessons, but it's certainly driven home how important who your mayor is and mm-hmm. who your local representatives are and who's on your city council. So it's those people that affect your actual day-to-day life much more than the president. And we just do such a bad job, especially at the political conventions, in driving that home. I mean, I think you can watch start to finish and have no idea who's running for Congress from your right. district. And that's just a bad idea. We have to serve people so much better than that.
Yeah. I mean, how are you thinking about election coverage right now connected to conventions? You know, when Trump tweets 2020 is going to be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history, and the press covers it, what are the externalities of that story? Like, what should the newsrooms be focusing on in the run-up to November? And this is like a moment where if they don't get it right, they're at fault.
Yes. No, I think that's 100% true. We have to do so much better of a job than we've done, and the time is running out. I think that it's really important to accept that you're going to have to dedicate time to the sort of boring mechanics, the like brass tacks of voting. It's not all sexy.
Your book should be required reading, right? For every single journalist out there.
It should just be a nationwide requirement. Perhaps an executive order could work exactly. With this. I hear they can be signed for nearly anything.
Yeah.
But news organizations, especially local news, needs to put out early and often where you can find the information and how it works and whether you can track your ballot. The option to put your ballot in a drop box rather than the mail, it's just details and it's not exciting to listen to. But, you know, one thing that I am a broken record about is I think any story on voting or voter fraud needs to answer the question, did I help people learn how they can cast a ballot?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe put a sidebar in. Anytime you're running a voter fraud story, put a sidebar in that says election deadlines and how to request your ballot and where to find the information.
Right. Well, part of the problem is that local news is not really what we watch anymore, is it? We watch national news, and our election system's so decentralized. So how, if we're all tuning into, you know, whether it's Fox or CNN, we're getting these national facts that are essentially like magazine stories. They're not newspaper stories.
Right.
And so how does national news communicate the facts properly, basically, when you're dealing with totally decentralized, state-driven?
It's certainly not an easy problem. I think one thing that they can do is direct viewers to organizations. So vote411.org is a League of Women Voters website that is then broken down by state. So they can send people to these national organizations that allow you to quickly break it down. And I think the other thing that they can do at the top, say you have to check your state, but point out the questions that everyone needs to ask about their state. So at least you know all of the issues. When's the deadline? How can I return? Can I track my ballot? Some states, all the ballots have barcodes, so you can track it from when they send it to you to when you put it in the mail and send it back. So just listing the questions that people should ask is one thing that I think the national news can focus on. But it's not easy to do because everything is so decentralized. But it is something that local media sites, newspapers, you know, to the extent that their reach may be limited, but if they put that info front and center on their webpage from now until the election, hopefully it'll work its way around.
Mm.
People know they're confused and know they need information in a way that I think is unusual. So all of Trump's voter fraud talk has led to a lot of confusion, but in a way, hopefully people will know that they need to work their way out of that confusion.
Is there any news that we can actually trust during this cycle? Like, what are you paying attention to? And who are some of the voices that are rising to the top for you or that you admire the most?
National news, I very much trust the New York Times and the Washington Post. I look at the polling sites, but with all sorts of caveats. But there are people like Michael Wines of the New York Times, who isn't big on Twitter, but follows the voting beat very specifically. There's a woman named Jessica Hoosman, who's very active on Twitter from ProPublica, that is amazing. But I don't think people have to get into the weeds. I think following your local news and then just keeping up with what's going on with voting rights in your area. Honestly, I think some of the best things people could do is Google their city lawsuit vote by mail, and that'll get you a lot of information of what you need to know about.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much confusion. This has long been the case around polling. And I was wondering, how do you view the accuracy or not of these polls and the media's inability, actually, as the last election proved, to capture the kind of true pulse of how the country is feeling during an election?
I had a whole chapter on polling because I, like everyone else, had missed the boat and hadn't thought about it in the way that I should have. You know, I think for polling, what the breakdown after 2016 showed, and what a lot of experts from all different parts of the polling world came to, was that, you know, look, the national polls weren't wrong. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton did win by a couple percentage. They thought it would be 3 and it would be 2. The problem was that wasn't the number that mattered. So the first thing I think when anyone thinks about polling is to make sure and not just look at that percentage chance of winning number, but what the actual projected percentage of the vote is, because there's a very different thing between an 80% chance of winning, but likely to get 49% of the vote. And so really recognizing that difference is a very important first step, and maybe just ignoring that percent chance of winning is a good thing. And then, you know, obviously what really matters is the state polls, and the state polls in swing states were just off in 2016. They just were.
Yeah.
They weren't weighted properly as far as college graduates and non-college graduates. And I think there's a lot of lessons learned from people who were doing those polls. You know, you can look at them, but you just can't live and die by them. And you right. have to make sure that they don't keep you from voting. I mean, it's like the cliche of the only poll that matters is election day is an obnoxious thing to say, but it's really true. I mean, if you can keep yourself from looking at the polls, hats off. And that is probably the best way to do it. I find myself incapable of doing that. So just making sure we're thinking more about them. But one hopes that they have made improvements, but we won't really know until after the election how right the polls were. And knowing that the state polls are really what matters, national polls are useless as far as the president.
What are your thoughts when it comes to social media, particularly Twitter, in terms of voting politics? Like, do you remain concerned also about Russia's meddling through these mediums? And
yes.
Should we be worried about China interfering too?
I think we have to be worried about it, of course. You know, the problem with trying to think through that is, yes, we have to be worried, and then what? Like, what does a person do? And I think it's just when we're looking at Twitter and Facebook and everything else, it really all comes down to news literacy. You know, Russia and China, at least in 2016, aren't messing with the actual voting numbers. They're messing with the voters.
Yeah.
And so knowing where your news comes from is just so important. And when your aunt sends you something on Facebook, really tracking down where it actually originates is basically the most important thing people can do. And not sharing anything that you don't know where it came from, I think is so important. I mean, one of the things I try to say in the book is do your best to know if the reporter who wrote that story was in the room.
Well, Jack Dorsey on The Daily last week was, you know, interviewed, and he was saying that they're experimenting with a new feature that you can't reshare something unless you've actually read it.
I know. I was like, I hope they do that. And then all of us in the media who retweet our friends constantly are going to do it. Are we going to be doing a lot more clicking as we should be?
Right.
Because I'm like such a nerd, I do try to open things before, you know, you try to read them before because headlines can be so off, and that's on the media too.
Well, do you think this election really comes down to a narrative war between China and Russia?
Oh, God, I hope not.
I mean, at the end of the day, isn't that a real possibility? China is highly incentivized and really hot and bothered.
Very hot and bothered.
With Trump. The Kung flu added some real insult to injury from the tariff war. And he's just poking an open wound constantly. And I think they've had enough. And it seems like China has a much more evolved understanding of how to manipulate through technology and the internet than Russia does.
I mean, look, I think that that very well could be true. I do think that even though all of that is happening, our news media here that hopefully is doing their job to serve and inform, and then all of the organizations on the ground, the grassroots organizations that deal person to person, I hope that that information can win out in the end. I mean, certainly those actors are going to manipulate as much as possible.
And we haven't really seen China show their might.
No, we haven't.
In that environment. And that's what's so interesting. Yeah. It's like, we saw what Russia can do.
Yeah.
Now let's see what China can do.
Yeah, it's true. Thank you for what I'll be thinking about at 3 a.m. this morning.
Sorry.
I think it's worth mentioning, too, just bringing up the fact that you point out in your book that the U.S. has the busiest election calendar in the world. So there's tons of opportunity for these other forces to play into our elections. Like you write that Americans have more opportunities to vote in 10 years than Japanese citizens do in a lifetime.
I found that so wild. That's a fact that came from these researchers at Columbia and Yale who spend all of their time figuring out really what makes people leave the house or go to their mailbox, like down to the minute level. I think the sort of beauty as far as that is most of our elections, China and Russia aren't going to care about. Like, we vote so much for our school board and city council and sheriff in some cases. So that's where the bulk of those come from. But yeah, just as a bottom line pro voting feeling that I have, it's pretty amazing when you think about it, how much and how often Americans can sort of shape the people who make decisions. Mm.
Do you think that somehow our system could improve or participation could improve if we slowed it down a bit?
You know, local elections happen, it does feel like, all the time. And a more consistent calendar state to state would be extremely helpful. More consistency state to state across the board would, I think, make a huge difference. But yeah, I mean, I don't think we should vote on fewer offices, but it would be helpful for everybody if election days were less frequent. So same amount of offices, but just sync them up much more.
Mm. Before we let you go, in thinking about how we emerge out of this, I mean, the pandemic, this just condition of directionless panic that we're all feeling right now, as we emerge out of this, what's your greatest hope?
My greatest hope is that everyone in 2020 who wants to vote can do it easily, and that the system works and holds for this election so we can make the improvements after. It's a big hope, but there are a lot of people who are doing everything they can to make it work. So yeah, that's my hope for the 2020 election, that everyone can vote safely and that more people than ever do it, and that we take the lessons learned and make big changes going forward. I mean, the pandemic just exposed a lot of things that many people already knew and threw them into the spotlight. And so if we can get through 2020 successfully, hopefully there will be momentum to make the system better for everyone.
Well, we appreciate all your efforts in helping to educate everyone and hoping that people read the book and learn more about what you've researched. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun chatting.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.